Hello and welcome to the EV Cafe Takeaway, a podcast focused on that zero emission future that we are all hoping for. Every week I am joined by one of the wonderful members of the EV Cafe crew, and this week it's JC!
Yay. Hello, darlings.
So good to have you along, John, as always. And every week we manage to get to speak to one of the pioneers, innovators, and collaborators in our industry. And this week, wow, we have a doctor in the house. Absolutely. Dr. Ewan McTurk. Welcome, Ewan. How are you?
Thank you. Really good, thanks. Thanks for having us on.
Oh, it's my pleasure, and it's really exciting because, you know, as I look back at your history, there was a few things that came out that everybody knows about or can know about quite easily. They can kind of Google you and look and see Green Business Plan winner in your university years, and also Discovery Challenge. I'm interested in that. But also, I discovered you're a big band trumpeter, which we'd love to talk about on that. But the all-important, very interesting fact is that Ewan, prior to being a doctor, was a gardener and won the Mauchline Flower Show Children's Garden Plate. Well done, Ewan.
Of sorts, yeah. It was the Mauchline Flower Show Children's Plate Garden Competition. And basically, when I was a young boy, I was really quite sort of green-fingered, and I was very much taken after my mum's side of the family on that. Having come across this competition, I had some ideas on how to replicate like a proper kind of miniature world on a plate. When you look at what most kids play in gardens, where it would be like, okay, here's a giant poppy that would be the equivalent of like a freaking, you know, giant redwood Californian tree or something. It's like this is not to scale. But, you know, when you're using tiny little bits of moss as grass and, you know, sort of tiny little buds as trees and just kind of lightly, you know, kind of lining them up on a kind of undulating garden path, you've got to get the terrain right and make it interesting as well, you know. So 96 to 98, I was unstoppable, I'm telling you, and it was controversial. 99 was controversial. I came second to a local primary school teacher's kid who did the giant redwood cedar poppy thing that I just described there. So yeah, I'm still not over that.
I've got let that, it
that
go.
Basket. It's mine. It's mine, I tell you.
Never worn a poppy for Remembrance Day since.
I just can't face it, honest.
So how have you not ended up on Beechgrove Garden, Ewan? Because for those who don't know, Beechgrove is like Gardener's World, but it's done on a budget of about 50 pence and only for Scotland. But it's our gardening programme. So how come?
So true. I mean, it's something that, you know, once you get into high school and you're kind of focused on studies and socialising and stuff, and then you go to university and you're focused on studies and even more socialising, and then, you know, you're living in rented properties where you don't really have much of a garden, things like that. It takes a while before you reach the kind of pipe and slippers suburbia stage again, and that's thankfully where I am after a lot of effort. So we are trying to make a nature garden now, and that nature garden is not spectacular, I will admit, to look at. There are people who do nature gardens where it's all meticulously planned, whereas in our case we've deliberately left decent swathes of the garden to do its own thing on purpose. And it's been amazing the wildlife we've had in there. Everything from amusingly stripy caterpillars right the way up to stoats, deer. You know, we've had an owl come to visit at one point. Yeah, it's been absolutely amazing. And I'm just so pleased at how it's turning out, because there are other houses in the vicinity where they're doing this horrible astroturf stuff that just kills nature, stone dead, and you also can't walk on it in summer because it's too hot, or, you know, paving over the driveway and then wondering why their house keeps getting flooded, that sort of thing, you know, because you've just lost the natural drainage. So we're trying to kind of compensate for that and then some. But yeah, absolutely, nature gardens full force at the moment.
I love this because we start talking about, I had no concept of what this plate garden thing was, and then it's suddenly come to life that it's basically a plate with a garden on it. It's just like, oh my goodness. But then we also, we managed to navigate to floodplains, killing the environment and all that kind of stuff. Ewan, what how did all of this happen? I mean, how old were you in 96-ish?
Oh, that would have been seven back then, yeah. So it's very much primary school age, you know. It's not like I was you know, aggressively contesting the results of 99 when I was like 21 or something. This was still very much primary school age.
So talk us through that, because I mean, I'm super curious to how, I mean, because obviously you're very academic, you're very passionate, very knowledgeable, and you know, and very committed to all of this. How did it all come about? You know, at sort of 7 years old, there's already budding. See what I did there? Yeah. A budding Ewan McTurk, a budding Dr. Ewan McTurk. What was it? What was the environment like for you as you grew up?
I would say that, again, it was heavily influenced by my mum's side of the family. So I remember my Aunt Maureen, the sort of birthday and Christmas presents I would get would generally have quite a kind of environmental slant to them. And one of the presents I remember from when I was really young was a kind of red card, green card game, which was a bit of a mean thing to give to someone who was colourblind, but I could just
I know the feeling.
And it was things that this was like very kind of early 90s. So the environmental awareness was really starting to kind of pick up then. So there were things like one of the red cards would be sprays with CFCs in them, that sort of deal, you know, which was very much a big thing back then. Green would be recycling, etc. And that just kind of became instilled as a sensible thing to do. And I would, you know, I started kind of nagging my parents to do more environmentally. That said, they were already pretty good at it. You know, the big giant sort of skip-sized bottle banks that you used to have back in the day were frequented even when they were considered a bit of a novelty. And, you know, when it came to recycling, reusing, knowing the value of objects and money. So, you know, that was a very good set of lessons to have. That said, you know, we grew up in, it was an ex-mining town, but we were in very much kind of middle-class suburbia within the ex-mining town. So, you know, thankfully, there was never any kind of financial struggles, but we always knew the value of things and the value of money and materials and so on. And it was always encouraged to try and be creative, with those. So that was a fantastic environment to grow up in from a sort of creative side. But I was also having these environmental and to some extent technical ideas instilled as well at an early age. So that all kind of formulated to fast forward through the kind of teenage years and things. Parents were one of the first houses on the street to get solar panels back when the feed-in tariff was well over 40 pence a unit. So that would have been pricey to buy, but they'll still be laughing their way to the bank off the feed-in tariff on that. They've since developed this nasty habit of doing something wrong despite me having done it first and proven to them it works, and then going back and doing it right. So when they had their Honda Jazz, you can tell that they're OAPs now, they have a Honda Jazz, or did have a Honda Jazz. And I said, you need to get an EV. They're absolutely brilliant. And they went and bought another Honda Jazz. And I was just absolutely livid with them. I was like, seriously, why didn't you just get a Leaf? They got a Leaf. And they were like, we should have done this earlier. It's great. They've now got a new Kia Soul, which is just, you know, an indefatigable machine, as we know, really good range, really good charging on it and stuff. They've now gone and got the heat pump, but they were suckered by the greasy sales agent into getting one of these so-called hybrid heat pumps, where it's basically, you know, they say it's going to be hydrogen ready. I can guarantee you that thing will never see hydrogen in its life. And it's predominantly gas doing heavy lifting because it's got no means of storing hot water. So yeah, still a bit ticked off with them for that. But you know, they will... They kind of half get the message. Some other members of the family are a lot better at it. So one of my cousins is away to get a Jaguar I-Pace soon, hopefully. And another of my cousins, who you'll know, Eleanor Chalmers, she's electric. Mm. She got a Leaf shortly after being taken for a spin in my first EV, and then became very savvy on social media about it, became very well known in the mid-2010s as an EV ambassador. So anyway, just totally ranting on, but there's been that kind of green mindset within the family, but it was definitely me that properly kind of pulled that together and started being more kind of vocal and proactive about it, rather than it just being some sort of subconscious, well, I suppose this makes sense to do. It was me that started kind of, you know, broadcasting it and trying to push others in a constructive way to do it.
So from all of that, Ewan, the thing I take away is that I have something in common with the great Dr. Ewan McTurk, and in that I'm colorblind also. And that's probably the closest I'll ever get to sharing any kind of level platform with your good self.
Well, colorblindness is actually something that also shaped my career path, funnily enough, because it kiboshed a young, wide-eyed, innocent Ewan's dreams of being a train driver. So, you know, Thomas the Tank for life, you know, when you're that age, you know, obviously, you know, Peppa Pig and all these ones hadn't come along yet. It was still Thomas the Tank that was like the best, officially the most popular kids show of all time or something. And it was like, oh, I want to be a train driver. And then it was like, oh, yeah, you can't be colorblind in case you don't read the signals right. It's like, oh, what do I do now? And then I told
you, I know, I'll be a battery chemist.
Yeah, but the thing is, I toyed with being a doctor, but it was a medical doctor, and then thought, no, actually, I'm more interested in the kind of tech side of things. Discovered I was quite good at computers, and we'll come back to that, because that's kind of something else that kind of shaped something that went on. But I'd kind of resigned myself to doing computing when I was looking through the university prospectuses. Should really know the plural of prospectuses. Anyway, yeah, looking through them all, and I discovered renewable energy was a degree, and it was a technical degree. It was an applied physics degree at the University of Dundee, and went, wow, okay, everything that I've been interested in, the kind of techie engineering side, and obviously the environmental side, boom, done, I'm applying for that. And that was my, I think it was, yeah, it was my one and only application that I made, I think. So, yeah.
So Ewan, when you were at school, I've spoken to some people from my school days, and they said I was a bit of a nerd. And I was slightly hurt by that, but it's actually quite a compliment, I think. Were you a nerd?
I would have been perceived as one, and I probably was one as well. So like ex-mining town, growing up in the 90s, the main kind of hobby, of course, was football. Everyone was into football. I was not into football. I was into Robot Wars. I was into, you know, more and Scrappy Challenge and more kind of techie stuff like that. And it was a totally different language. And not only, well, speaking of language, this is not representative of the accent of Cumdock. I mean, I can ramp it up for you if you want, but you know, when you go to primary school, speaking like this, you are automatically, and pardon my language here, are we allowed to swear?
Yeah.
So you're automatically a posh and then on top of that,
when we said swear. So
okay, well, we can bleep that.
See,
out.
No, no, we can now, bleep now, actually, I think we need to do a little bit of education here, in that in Scotland, when you use the C word, you don't actually mean that. It's kind of like somebody, it's a person. So if you're a posh, you're a posh person, you're a posh bloke, posh girl, whatever it might be, you don't actually mean it in the way that in England you might use it.
Yes. It's totally fine.
Just leave it in England.
Yeah, yeah. The fascinating thing is,
if you're listening in England.
The fascinating thing is that in Scotland, that word has negative, neutral, and positive connotations depending on the way it's used. So there is the Ewan, you're a ginger, specky, poofy, posh, which is what I heard all the time. There's the someone new walks into the bar and you don't know who they are. Who's this? And then there's the, you know, and then John and I are a few jars in at the bar, and I just put my arm around you. He's like, you're a good. And that's the three versions of that. So if you genuinely want to leave this bit in for the kind of post-watershed, that's your negative, neutral, and positive connotations of that word. It's interesting how Scotland has weaved it into its language.
And we link that back to positive and neutral and, you know. John, I interrupted.
No, all I was going to say was that we have Joe, who's our producer, and he's sitting with his head in his hands at the moment thinking, how am I going to edit this nightmare?
He's just written, this will be funny to bleep out, so there we go.
So let's go back to school. So did you have a close-knit group of friends, or were you the guy who's kind of stood at the edge of the playground and nobody spoke to? What was school like?
It was quite interesting. So like primary school, when I went in there initially, I remember being like very much in there with loads of different people, really quite social. And then, like, there were a couple of bullies who kind of picked up on this guy speaks differently from the rest of us. This guy seems to be getting good grades without swatting too much. Clearly got jealous of the fact that I would have been getting good attention from the teacher rather than bad attention. And every single day was bullying from that point. And that marginalised me, and I did become isolated. This continued to an extent in secondary school, but there were definitely more friends that I had there. And part of that came from, and this actually something you mentioned earlier, which was the kind of jazz trumpeter side of things. So the jazz trumpeter side of things originates from being a cornetist. So, you know, kind of a squished, more mellow sounding trumpet, which is a common thing to find in the silver bands of ex-mining towns. So, you know, an East Ayrshire ex-mining town, of course, the high school has a brass band. And that was sheer fluke, because the head of the Cumnock Academy Music Department, who's sadly no longer with us now, but Mrs. Astley, she taught me how to play piano. And I remember one day getting a lesson from her, and I kind of zoned out for 5 seconds. And she was like, she was saying, I was speaking to Mr. Patterson, oh, who's also no longer with us, the brass band instructor from Cumnock Academy. Gutted, we've lost a lot of good people. Anyway, she was saying, I was speaking to Gary Patterson. He says he'd be up for giving you a try with a cornet if you want. I was just going, yeah, okay. And then she said, excellent, we'll arrange cornet lessons for next week. What Mrs. Astley didn't know is that I really didn't like brass instruments for some reason. And I was like, oh, no, you don't have to, honestly. But I'm so glad I went along to it, because I ended up not just having a great time, which extended into picking up a trumpet, virtually the same thing, you know, and going into a big band at university, which was an absolute hoot, an absolute riot. But also meeting some incredible people along the way, including a close band of friends who, no pun intended, gave us a kind of safe refuge during intervals and lunchtimes and stuff at high school, because a lot of the band kids would hang out in the same room in the music department. So, that was very much a safe refuge. And, you know, people generally got on very well there. And that was where I met the nicest person I've ever met in my life. So I'm an only child, but the person who was basically the big sister I never had and looked out for me and for quite a lot of other people was incredibly popular, the nicest, most popular person. And that her name was Laura. And she, it was a couple of years older than me also, well, she played flugelhorn. Which is again like a more mellow kind of cornet, but yeah, just genuinely so nice, friendly, supportive. I never heard her say a bad word about anyone or anything, and to the extent there would literally be people queuing up to chat with her. So you get the bullying and the horrible stuff going on during the week, but I had someone and something to look forward to during that week, and that was pretty much what kept me going. And not just that, but and I was indulging my nerdery. So when I was trying to kind of flex my technical abilities ahead of going to university, I built a robot, basically. I built a replica of one of the Robot Wars champions. If anyone remembers Chaos 2, well, I built Chaos 2.5. And it was just this kind of lightweight version of it. And she would always ask, oh, how's the robot? And I would say, oh, yeah, the latest that we've done with it is this. And I just remember her saying, you do know it's going like this, but please do continue. She was just so supportive. And, of course, it was her that got cancer, because it's just that the arbitrary nature of cancer is the most horrible thing. I just remember someone else saying, why couldn't it have been some little shit that got it? And, yeah, that still hurts. You know, I think it does for everyone. She was genuinely just, yeah, absolutely awesome. Genuinely never put a foot wrong. But
left her mark. And I suppose that's the thing,
isn't
it?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
That we all have that opportunity to leave a positive memory, something behind. So even though we're gone, we're not gone.
Oh,
we're
yeah.
We're still living. She's living in you.
Yeah, I was going to say, genuinely, she will leave this earth when the last of the people, obviously, like her family and friends and everyone in that music department, we'll carry her on to the very end. No one's forgetting her in a hurry, I can tell you that much. And there'll be people who we've told about her as well, and that will continue on. So like she's but definitely was a very positive influence, because she didn't just teach the well, she didn't even just give me something to look forward to in terms of just that friendship and that support. She kind of taught me the value of kindness as well. And there are definitely situations where I could have just lunged into something and gone for the jugular. But I've kind of taken a step back and gone, how can we do this in a way that everyone's going to understand it and we can kind of reach some sort of common ground? And yeah, that's powerful. So yeah, I have a lot to thank her for.
What would Laura do? Because that's the question we all need to ask sometimes. What would Laura do?
Yeah, no, totally. And it's school is a funny time. And I think, you know, whenever we see brilliant people, and I put you in that bracket, of course, Ewan, you realize that actually, not you weren't. Although I do put you in that bracket, actually. But it's not about you. It's about Ewan. Anyway.
Ah, sorry, I misunderstood.
Yes. But it is often common that the most brilliant people are people that have had a tough time for various reasons, because nobody likes people that stand out when they're younger. And I think we all look for that person that stands out, and then we take the mickey and what's different about that person? Oh, well, they're clever, they're specky, they're whatever it might be. We kind of pick on those things, but when you've got one or two people like Laura that come alongside you and you find your niche, then boy, doesn't it ever explode into something brilliant, as it has done. So question, do you still play the trumpet?
I am horrifically out of practice, and it is to my shame. Likewise with the piano. So I got to grade 8 on the piano, could play Claire de Lune off by heart and things like that. And I look back and think, yeah, I'd love to be able to do that again. I then went to university, couldn't take a piano with me. Yes, there were pianos, but I didn't really have enough time to get near them. I then joined the big band by sheer fluke. There were some people in one of my classes at uni, well, it was one of them anyway, who said, oh, I play saxophone, I'm going to try out for, I say try out, it was like anyone could join the big band. Do you play anything? So, oh, I play the cornet. He's like, yeah, well, come along. And so through there, that was Robert, one of my good mates from uni. Through there, we met Sato, who became one of our flatmates, and then kind of the extended Dundee gang, I suppose, kind of formed from there at university. But a lot of them were either from the big band or kind of our extended groupies, if you wish. So that was great. But yeah, I played trumpet until 2014. Which is when, so basically I'd already graduated from University of Dundee, but I was working at St Andrews with Professor Peter Bruce's research group on lithium air battery tech at the time, which is just across the bridge from Dundee. And quite a few of the St Andrewsians would be like, oh, Dundee, I've heard the horror stories. And it's like, all right, well, I've been there since 2006. I've seen how this place was already awesome and is improving exponentially. So screw you guys. You get a hell of a lot more bang for your buck and far more of a social life if you live on the other side of the bridge in Dundee. So I lived there and commuted there in my vintage electromobile on £1's worth of ecotricity back when renewable energy was more expensive than gas. But anyway, so I continued to stay on in Dundee University Big Band as well. And it was only when Peter Bruce moved his research group down to Oxford that very much put a hard stop on my involvement in the big band. And again, having kind of reached kind of pipe and slippers in Dundee, and I had a nice house to myself, and I kind of had room for any hobbies and passions and things, and then having to try and squeeze that all into one room that was more expensive than the entire house in Dundee. You know, I do still have the trumpet, but I didn't take it with me, and I've yet to pick it up since, which is really bad of me. I should try and get back into it, because it's great fun when you're in a big band.
Well, we'll have to get you onto a live Eevee cafe somewhere, and you can come along, but you're only allowed on if you bring your trumpet.
I can bring it. I might not be playing it. I mean,
you got to play it.
If you're out of practice on a trumpet, you sound like a flatulent duck. So it's, you know, you want to make, I need time to try and practice it.
Well, best get yourself ready.
I mean, that said, you know, the trumpet was, I could have been properly good at it, but annoyingly, I had braces fitted during high school, and I had just been promoted to first trumpet, so like, you know, the hardest part. and then had braces fitted, and that completely changed, of course, the way that your lips interact with the mouthpiece. And it basically meant I had to relearn the instrument, and I had the braces taken off, I had to relearn it again. And then fatigue just set, as in like your lips would just knacker themselves a lot faster than they used to. And that seems to be either a permanent thing or something that would take a heck of a lot of practice to overcome. Either way, I never quite fully recovered. So I would kind of languish towards kind of second or third trumpet parts generally within the big band. But yeah, I did kind of reach that peak and then truly had it taken away. But on the plus side, I now have straight teeth, so you know, all adds. There's swings and roundabouts, I guess.
Absolutely. And you mentioned Professor Bruce. Was yes. Did you say Robert Bruce?
No. Professor Robert Bruce. No, Professor Peter Bruce. Professor Robert Peter Bruce. Bruce. He's instrumental in his own field, of course.
But, I just thought he might have been named after him. That Bruce. Anyway, so he went to. So, does your doctorate come from Oxford?
It does.
That's quite powerful, isn't it? How did all that feel? Because that must have felt a really good moment where you got that.
Well, it's interesting because when Peter announced that the group was relocating to Oxford, my initial thought was, "Oh God!" Because I had carved out this fantastic niche in Dundee. A lot of my good friends were there. Family wasn't too far away over on the West Coast. But as I say, I had an amazing community within Dundee. I was really enjoying where I was at. I had my vintage electromobiles and I had a place that I could keep them. So I had the 106 Electric and the Mark 1 Honda Insight as well, both of which are in transport museums at the moment. But I kind of had this... Yeah, you know, I was kind of ahead of where I wanted to be in life in terms of the kind of... material possession side of things I would have wanted, I guess. I had to sacrifice all that. Plus, on top of that, my other half was based in Edinburgh. So I would see her at the weekends. You know, it was only about an hour or so to get from Dundee to Edinburgh. And then all of a sudden, it was like, oh, I'm going to be 400 miles away. This is problematic. And that was an annoyance. And I did kind of look into other opportunities at that point. But I decided in the end, I'm going to go to Oxford. But I'm going to be straight in, straight out, no messing about, not really caring about the collegiate system, the whole thing about how they put the sorting hat on you and tell you you're in Gryffindor or whatever. I picked the greenest college, Lineker College, but unfortunately the building I was in won its green awards in 1996, and that was a long, long time away. So it was funny because they had this big poster as you came in, and they said, "We use gas-fired ovens because gas is cleaner than the coal-fired electricity of the UK national grid." Bearing in mind that this was now 2014, when we were well on the way to kicking coal out off the grid, it was like, "Are you kidding me? You've still not updated any of this." And yeah, Oxford was congested, expensive, polluted. There was no camaraderie like there was in Dundee. So a prime example of this is shortly after taking my bike out on my first run to the nearest supermarket. Another thing that annoyed me about Oxford was that all of the supermarkets within the city centre were either tiny little Tesco's or tiny little Sainsbury's. There were lots of them, but they could only fit so much in, so there wasn't much variety. Whereas, you know, Dundee, there was a big supermarket, a 5 minute drive, 20 minute cycle away, and it was you know, you had everything you could possibly want. Anyway, point is that the chain or something came off my bike, and I couldn't figure out what it was. And I had this bike upside down for about 10 minutes trying to figure it out. Turned out it was actually a support of one of the mud guards had come loose and jammed the front wheel. So I'm glad I didn't go over the handlebar. Point is that at least 100 people walked past me, not one of them offered to help. In Dundee, the chain came off my bike twice on the same street, with only one other person on it on the opposite side of the road. Different person each time. "Oh, you doing okay there? Do you need a hand?" And that's just because Dundee is this big village, this proper kind of camaraderie. And that's, you know, that wasn't necessarily a student or anyone. That was just someone from Dundee. But the students as well, like Dundee's university is a centralised campus, but right in the heart of the city. So like it's genuinely a really vibrant place to be. It always gets like the top award for best student experience. And I could definitely vouch for that. One of the best parts of my life would have been coming up towards the end of that stint in Dundee. Because as I said, you know, the kind of material possession wise, having the vintage electromobiles and things, that was good. But also just the group of friends I had there, and the very diverse group of friends from different kind of walks of life, was brilliant. And it genuinely got to the stage where I had to add an extra 10, 20 minutes on from walking from my house, which was close to the city centre, into the city centre. I had to add on an extra 10 or 20 minutes because of the number of people I would bump into along the way and would stop and have a chat. The sun's always shining in Dundee, so everyone's just wandering about high-fiving each other. They love it. So, like, it honestly was such a happy, happy time. And to go from that to stress levels that would make a fighter pilot think, oh, wow, you need to take a break, mate. But, yeah, I went straight in. I got the work done. And on the plus side, I did meet some pretty cool people. So, for example, Professor David Howie, who basically became my other supervisor. Christoph Burkle, who's now the founder and CEO of Brill Power, which is a very clever battery management system company. Christoph and I were like that. We kind of joined at the hip. We did amazing work together, published several papers, and the speed and proficiency of our communication. We were in two totally different buildings, but we always happened to be checking our emails at the exact right time, and it just accelerated the progress of this exciting science. And it was great, but also got on really well outside the lab as well. And he was definitely one of the people who kept me sane, because he was far more kind of down to earth and really quite a really approachable guy. Like the entire group that they were in were a fantastic bunch as well. So yeah, that helped. I've been ranting on quite a bit. Sorry.
Not at all, Ewan. It's interesting because really you started to talk about some of the challenges that you faced in your life, because it would be very easy to look at you and say, you know, here's a guy who is clearly very intelligent, very capable, good with people, all that stuff. Life has been good to Dr. Ewan McTurk, and he's been to Oxford, and it's, you know, all marvellous. Life's not like that, and sometimes there are those challenges, and you've alluded to a couple of things there. What's the thing which has been really the toughest in your life that's made you dig the deepest to find out who you genuinely are? Forget your brains, forget your qualifications. The man. What's the thing that's tested the man most?
I would say there's two or three different bits to that. And, well, probably the outright toughest would be pretty much being bullied solidly every single day of primary school, from about primary two, primary three, all the way through to pretty much, it was only towards sixth year, the final year of high school, that it stopped. It was weird, actually, because in sixth year, the very people who gave you grief the year before, it was almost like it was a play, and they were taking a curtain call, and everyone's hand in hand, you know, and all of a sudden they would chat to you as a person and give you respect. It's like, what the heck's going on here? I mean, I'll take it, but wow. But there were, I think probably when, you know, there were still some controversies in that final year of school. So, for example, Young Enterprise, which is a thing to try and encourage entrepreneurialism in high schools. I was involved in a business for that, and we had a little stall near the kind of canteen, and we would sell various bits and pieces with the aim to try and at least in part raise money for cancer research with hands down the most popular person in the school, who was popular on the merit of just sheer, complete and utter pure kindness. And I remember that the prom committee liked the ideas of the products we were selling and started kind of copying them and using their clout to try and kind of shut out our opportunities. It kind of reached ahead, and I ended up, well, actually, it literally reached the head. I ended up having a chat with the headmaster at the school at the time. And I remember him saying, well, so how much money are you going to be raising? I said, yeah, well, there'll be at least a few hundred quid in it at this rate. He said, oh, you do realise that won't be enough to fund one round of chemotherapy. And I was like, hang on, roll back just a minute. One. It's cancer research. They're not funding chemo drugs. They're funding ways so that people don't have to lose their hair and projectile vomit and go through absolute hell. Two, what the actual fuck? You know, how dare you say that to someone who is genuinely trying to save the kindest person in this school? It was absolutely abhorrent. And that made me dig deep, because it was like, I'm not taking that. And we kept on. So, we stuck it to them. We managed to.
Your instinct was to say, no, I'm not having that, actually.
Absolutely not. No. You know, I was fighting for good.
So highly principled human being. You're somebody who wears your heart on your sleeve and says, you know, I don't agree with that. and so I'm going to fight against it.
Yeah, and this is something that I kind of do, you know, sort of day to day now. I'm trying to fight for good in terms of basically trying to make sure that we have a planet and, you know, that we can actually inhabit. And you know, nature I find fascinating as well, and the fact that nature doesn't necessarily have a voice, and you've got untold destruction taking place, and you want to try and stop that. But this situation back at school, I was fighting for a physical embodiment of good. There was a person there, a person that literally no one had anything bad to say about. And this was like, no, this isn't happening on my watch. We are going ahead with this.
What keeps you doing that? Because, you know, there are two ways of dealing with this at least. And one of them is to say, do you know what? I'll just give in. I'll just say, do you know what? I've done my best. I've done my bit. I can't go against the head and the school and everything else that's going on. I'm just going to bury my head. So what is it in you that makes you want to fight it?
That's a great question. I think that there is just something now that's instilled there that means that I can't stop. I am incredibly persistent on these matters. And if if I seem to have exhausted all avenues, then I might take a rest, but then there will just be something deep within my core that just kind of fires up again. As soon as an opportunity presents itself, as soon as a new avenue to try and sort the thing, whatever it is, comes along. I'm definitely a fixer. I do try and solve issues, which can result in overload. There is a risk of it running in overload, especially if people try to take advantage of the fact that I try to fix things, which makes running a consultancy interesting, because bearing in mind that a lot of what my consultancy work is what I did in my spare time whilst I was a full-time lab-based electrochemist, but I now obviously need to make sure I get paid to do it. Otherwise, you know, I don't have money to feed myself. So, you know, it's difficult because there is that inherent drive to do good and try and help people. But yeah, as I say, there is definitely, if the cause is good enough, there'll be something that will say, just something instinctively that will say that there's a new opportunity to try and fix this. Let's pursue it. Mm-hmm. So it's now so deeply sort of subconscious and hardwired that I can't quite pinpoint it, but there is definitely a relentlessness. And I'm quite glad that this is a relentlessness that is being used for forces for good rather than forces for bad, because I think that without some of those positive influences in my life, who knows what way it could have gone. So I'm really, really pleased that I met some of the incredible people I had, was raised by and surrounded by some really, really good people throughout, you know, very various key stages of my life.
It's been a fantastic journey, and I think we've got a real picture of the engine room that is within, you know, Dr. Ewan McTurk. It genuinely is fascinating. I love it, and I think within that relentlessness, that you're achieving things all of the time. I mean, you are, you know, you're delivering, you know, developments for companies that they probably wouldn't have aspired to. You're achieving some good end that people couldn't have done without your assistance and without that insight and without that relentlessness that you have. What is the thing that has stood out so far as being like, wow, that's pretty damn cool, actually. I'm quite proud of that.
You know, again, that's amazing. Because annoyingly, I do kind of focus on the things that I would still quite like to do rather than necessarily the bits that have worked out so well. I mean, there are definitely a few. I would say that having started a business, a proper business, has taken me by surprise how well it's gone. So actually, do you know what? Even earlier than that, Plug Life Television, the YouTube channel. So this was an idea that I'd had in my mind for some time. I wanted to try and get some information out there. I'd initially thought about doing EV reviews, but obviously quite a lot of people are doing EV reviews. And, you know, I could have put more of an electrochemistry slant on it. But then I realized one day when I was sitting in a conference in Edinburgh and someone had asked some very good questions about batteries, with an air of skepticism, but they were very good questions to do with, you know, ethics and lifespan and so on. And the panelists all gave very wishy-washy responses because they didn't have those answers. And I was sitting there with the answers in my mind and I went, yeah, I need to be able to get that out there. So at that point, combined with, it was a case of, well, I need to come up with a name for this. And then I remembered a meme that I'd entered into the My Energy hashtag Happy Zappy competition at Fully Charged Live to win a My Energy Zappy. And it was me standing next to the Peugeot 106 Electric, with the kind of deal with it sunglasses kind of photoshopped on, and then in that font, Plug Life. And it was like, okay, we have a name, let's do this. And on top of that, how am I going to be able to illustrate some of these points? Well, back in high school, during my young enterprise days, I had pushed PowerPoint to its limits to try and do some sort of swishy presentations. It was basically like a video, like a one click, all automatically animated and so on. So I knew my way around PowerPoint. It was like, excellent. If I am determined enough, and also actually my PhD supervisor, Peter Bruce, had taken full advantage of that with some of the like 3D animated graphics of how batteries work that I'd done back in the day. So it was like, okay, I know exactly what the first episode is going to be. I know exactly what it's called. Just need to put it together. And it went from there. And without ever once uttering the L word and the S word, which I refuse to do because if people like it, they'll find it, it ended up gathering this following and getting quite a lot of respect. And that is what resulted in the consultancy being founded, because it became apparent that lots of people need to hire a tame electrochemist to cover various different projects. So I think I was constrained when I was working for someone else, because I'd be constrained by the bandwidth of that business. And I would come to them with amazing ideas, and they would say, we can't do it. We don't have enough resources. And I can now go off and help with those. I mean, I don't have my own massive kick-ass lab anymore. I don't have a dedicated team or anything. It is just me, but I can work with the right people to make it happen. And, I've helped to net some serious like government funding for some really exciting projects and things like that. And the feedback that I've had from some of the projects in particular, I can't say too much at this stage, but when you've got at the likes of Fully Charged Live, when you've got CEOs of companies within that sector kind of literally surrounding you, eyes wide open, like, whoa, okay, this is good, we should do this. that's when it's going from that kind of frustrated futility of, oh, someone should come up with this, but what am I to do? I'm just a cog in the machine. No. You know what? I'm going to build my own machine.
And you're a gear stick.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I suppose it would be more of a sort of drive selector for an EV, wouldn't it? Rather than
of course. Yeah. Hey, listen, you said cog in the big machine. Well, with the analogy,
Very true. But absolutely. That's been quite cool to kind of achieve that. There'll be other things that come to mind as well, no doubt. But
Ewan, it's fabulous because, I know some of the help that you've provided and we work with one of the companies on the same company, and the help that you provide, I don't know of anybody else that could provide it. And it's like, I mean, the three of us here, very unique cogs in the whole machine of whatever it is, the machine of life, let's go with. And you bring your uniqueness and you bring that understanding. And it's exciting as you look at the future, and in particularly with your area of expertise, I would love to understand what you're seeing coming in the future for batteries in particular in relation to vehicles, because we've still got so many challenges to solve. We still, in some instances, don't go far enough. We still have, I came from the motorhome market, they've built a motorhome on a 4D Transit, very respectable vehicle, really good vehicle. It'll do 108 miles and it's got no weight capacity, no payload because of all the stuff that's on it. When are we going to see, more energy dense batteries? When are we going to see different chemistries that will take away the concerns around fire and mining and all of those kinds of things? What does the future look like? Give us hope.
Yeah, well, I mean, already on the latter point, lithium iron phosphate takes away any concerns about fire. Lithium iron phosphate just doesn't catch fire. If you manage to get it to catch fire, I think you get a telegram from King Charles. It's like, what happens is, so lithium iron phosphate is the cathode material, positive electrode. Most electric vehicle batteries, until Tesla came along with the standard range Model 3 and said, hold my non-alcoholic beer, most of them used lithium, nickel, manganese, cobalt oxide, NMC. Generally, if it's got cobalt in it, it will be flammable in a worst case scenario. But that worst case scenario is still between 20 and 60 times less likely than a petrol or diesel car to catch fire. So let's just remember that. The point is that LFP, the oxygen within that structure is far more tightly bound to it than it is in NMC. So if you were to drill through an NMC cell, it would very quickly discharge. And that would generate a lot of heat. That would cause the electrolyte and the positive electrode to decompose, the cathode. So the cathode would decompose, the oxygen would evolve as well. So you've got various flammable hydrocarbons, you've got your oxygen, and you've got heat. That's your triangle of fire, and that's why it will combust. But nowhere near as badly as a ruptured fuel tank. With lithium iron phosphate, the oxygen's far more tightly bound to it. So you've got some hot gas, but you've not really got that much oxygen. So, yeah, I mean, it might vent some hot gas, but it won't catch fire. It's a far safer chemistry. And in fact, the latest innovation is the BYD blade cell, which is also lithium iron phosphate, but it doesn't even get that warm. You can drill straight through it fully charged, and it only gets to about 60 degrees C. So you can mangle that and it'll be fine.
They do that, don't they? They take a six-inch nail and they pierce the whole cell to see how it reacts. Nothing. Absolutely nothing.
Yeah, exactly. There is that video on YouTube. And if you fast forward to about 40 seconds into it, the BYD video, and listen to it with the sound up, you will hear the textbook definition of an anticlimax. And in fact, if Joe's up for it, we can try and splice that into this podcast now.
Okay.
He's good.
There we go. Right. That was fun, wasn't it? Right. So, but the other thing that is quite exciting about, you know, the tech that's on the horizon, you were saying about the Ford e-Transit camper van and its lack of payload. Well, lithium sulfur and silicon anodes will both help on that regard. Okay. In that regard. So silicon, you're replacing graphite. Graphite is necessary as a safety procedure because it allows lithium ions to pigeonhole themselves into the negative electrode, the graphite structure, without plating unevenly and forming these little branch-like growths called dendrites that eventually puncture the separator and short-circuit the cell internally by touching the positive electrode, which means you've got an electrical pathway within the cell. So even if you disconnect the terminals, it can still discharge itself rather than having to just go around the outside circuit. That's why if you remove the terminals, obviously the cell stops discharging unless it's short-circuited. Anyway, the point is that with your silicon anodes, you go from needing 6 carbon atoms just to store 1 lithium atom to 1 silicon atom storing 4 lithium atoms. So massive improvement in energy density. You've just shrunk the negative electrode massively.
Is this solid state, as they call it?
No. Solid state, so that's when you're removing the separator and the liquid electrolyte and replacing them with a solid electrolyte that does both of those jobs. That's also on the horizon. That will also improve energy density. It's believed that it's reasonably safe to use with pure lithium anodes, so you've even removed the silicon and stuff. The ideal is to have just pure lithium, or in fact, the ultimate ideal is just to have is to basically trace the eminent. So you've got your copper current collector, which connects the inside of the cell to the outside world, and then just have that clean sheet of copper, and then load the lithium into the positive electrode, kind of overload it with lithium. So the first time you charge it, it just splats itself against the copper. And then when you're discharging, it just comes off the copper again and splats onto it, rather than having a constant presence of lithium in the negative electrode. So what does that give us?
What does that give us in terms of improvements? Or what might we see in terms of energy density, kilowatt hours for weight, that sort of balance?
Each of those technologies, silicon anode and solid state, conservatively should give a sort of 50% to 100% increase in energy density. So potentially doubling the range of the vehicle for the exact same size / weight of battery each. Brilliant. So yeah, big progress there. But what's particularly good is, because obviously we've talked about volumetric energy density, which is, you know, being able to squeeze into a certain space, but you've talked about the you know, the actual payload of the vehicle being problematic, and that's where you need your gravimetric energy density. That's your, you know, your weight of it. So watt hours per kilogram rather than watt hours per liter.
Yeah,
and that's where lithium sulfur is interesting, because sulfur, incidentally, we have massive stockpiles of from oil and gas refining. So obviously you desulfurize. Yeah, exactly. So there's just massive mountains of this yellow eggy stuff at oil refineries, and it's like, what are we going to do with this? Well, we have a cunning plan. We can use it as the positive electrode. That means you've got no nickel, no cobalt. You've not even got your iron or your phosphorus or anything from LFP. LFP is basically lithium plus rust. It's very cheap to make. But point is that, you know, your sulfur is even cheaper, allegedly. There are attempts to use it with, again, a pure lithium foil. But the advantage there is that because sulfur is so light, you'd be looking at roughly the same capacity of battery pack as is currently in the Transit, because the volumetric energy density is roughly the same. But you'd be looking at about approaching half the weight, you know, 400 to 500 watt hours per kilogram. 400 to 500 watt hours per kilogram at cell level. Aerospace is very interested in this. Buses and trucks are very interested in this. Frustratingly, one of the world leaders was Oxis, which was a UK company. It was in the process of building its first factory, proper factory, rather than just pilot production line in Brazil, funnily enough, for trucks and buses. And then they went under, as with so many good British businesses recently. Sadly, I mean, I'm trying to remember what's happened to the patents, because I know that Johnson Matthey bought them up and then sold them on again. Johnson Matthey, who just loves to kind of rage quit the battery sector at will. But yeah, anyway, I can't remember where those patents are now, but there is a very real risk that this UK head start is about to be squandered, and it will inevitably be one of the very talented Chinese cell manufacturers that will beat them to market. But hey, it's a good cell tech. It's good cell chemistry. It will definitely find its uses in those sort of applications. So yeah, worth keeping an eye on.
Fantastic. So, an eye on. We could do this all day.
Absolutely.
Sadly.
John, we're sort of coming to the end of our time. Have you got a couple of killer closing questions?
Yeah. Come on.
Go for bring it. Them
I've
on,
got
baby.
One. Ewan, you have the ability to make a fundamental difference to the world. What does that look like for you? What does success look like for you? How will you know that you've delivered on your potential?
So I think there are so many technologies out there just now that people who already use know make absolute sense. So people who've got electric vehicles know that they make absolute sense. People who cycle to work on a decent cycle path know that that makes absolute sense. People who've got heat pumps in not even particularly well-insulated homes like this one know that they make absolute sense. And people in the know that it's fossil fuels that have jacked up our cost of living right across the board. Not just, ironically, it's gas that's driven up the price of electricity. And of course, the rise in the cost of petrol and diesel means that a logistics sector that's been slow to electrify has meant that the cost of everything like orange juice in Tesco has gone up because it's more expensive to ship. It's when we get to the stage that the average person on the street understands that, properly understands it, even if they don't realize that they understand it, just the kind of thing that they will say in a very kind of off-the-cuff manner, in the same way that that person will say, oh yeah, but the lithium batteries in that EV only last 5 years, don't they? Oh, but the kids that mine the lithium, you're actually thinking cobalt, and there's not that many kids involved, and artisanal mining is not restricted to cobalt. Actually, cobalt is a very small amount of artisanal mining worldwide. Are you that worried about the other kids in artisanal mining? Nah, okay, cool. Right, anyway, yeah, yeah, all these sort of things. But that said, the mainstream media is just bombarding people with absolute garbage right now. And to be honest, the Telegraph's particularly bad at it because their energy editor is an oil and gas lobbyist. So that's why we've seen so many hit pieces recently. Private Eye just did a fantastic expose on that on Telegraph. So definitely worth checking that out. But yeah, there is a lot of corrupt power in those kind of mainstream media sources. And that corrupt power seems to be making it very difficult to try and get the genuine stats out there. The not even kind of, you know, bleeding heart environmentalist slants on it. We're talking the cold, hard, logical, mathematical facts of the matter. They're not interested because it doesn't sell clicks and it doesn't suit their agenda. I will be happy if we can redress that balance before we lose vast swathes of not just, you know, habitable slash farmable land from a human perspective, but vast swathes of nature that had no say in the matter. So I am determined to try and fix that. And I'm determined to make sure that people are aware of what's going on, that people are aware that when it comes to decarbonisation, renewables, cost of living, implications thereof, the picture is already so much rosier than they are being led to believe in some quarters. And that picture gets rosier all of the time. I just get to try and direct people towards the correct source of that information and to get them to speak to people who've actually been doing this day in, day out and are practicing what they preach. You know, people who've got the solar panels, the heat pump, the EV, the whatever it may be. That would be the ultimate goal, to make sure that people are actually properly informed on this and that the immediate off the cuff response is the genuine logical facts of the matter. Because underneath this kind of determination to do this kind of force for good, there is definitely this kind of original Ewan that was not shaped by anyone else, like the Ewan I would have been otherwise, just this core of a very kind of steely, kind of mathematically minded, number crunchy, wouldn't look you in the eye sort of person who's just kind of sitting there, crunches the numbers and stuff. And then there'll be the kind of goodwill person who, version of me that has been built on by the amazing people I've met. And I'll say, okay, so, you know, the head of National Gas is trying to say that gas is going to be around for ages, but he's not factored in the fact that renewables plus storage will vastly bring down costs and will therefore win out financially and things like that as well. Does that make sense to you? That kind of the Ewan that's looking you in the eye just now will pass it to the steely kind of spectrum-y Ewan, I guess. Probably. I've not been tested, but I mean, come on. Anyway, yeah, and the thing is that, they'll hand that piece of paper to that very core Ewan, and without even looking up, we'll just be like, yes. And they'll just keep going away, crunching numbers again. Be like, okay, right, we put that out there. But if that very core of me goes, no, this doesn't make sense, or no, that's a bad idea, it doesn't happen. I don't act completely on emotion, or I try not to act completely on emotion. I try to back it up with that kind of cold, logical, pragmatic side of it as well. So yeah, that's going to be important to make sure that we're not just losing our cool, to make sure that there is genuinely truth behind what's being said.
But that all said, Ewan, I think the fact that you do lose your cool in that driven kind of going to see the headmaster WTF moments, yeah. I think that's an engine room that we all recognize actually is essential to seeing this. And today, Ewan, we've been able to inspect the, I suppose we should say, the motor room, because it's not an engine, is it? No, not in the traditional sense, but it is. It's a motor that is powering you forward. And I actually believe that you will do a lot of what you've just set out in there. I do think we maybe need a new Plug Life TV video on this latest iteration. If I was to wag a finger at you, Dr. Ewan McTurk, you know what I'm going to say. We haven't seen enough.
Yes.
Plug Life Television for the last couple of months or so.
There is a very good reason for that. Plug Life Consulting has kept me so busy, I've not had time to do new episodes. There are new episodes in the pipeline. Although, interestingly, I can officially reveal there are at least three episodes being developed that will have a very different look and feel to them. One of them was actually to do with my heat pump and is basically the video that I wish had been on YouTube when I was looking into service plans. Brilliant. And things like that. So keep an eye out for that. But also, I teamed up with the former creative director of Fully Charged, Mark Taylor Hankins, who's done some incredible work with the series. Particularly the, I think the Estonia episodes were like critically acclaimed and things like this when they went to Zscaler's and Ultra Capacitors. He also filmed Robert going around Peter Bruce and David Howie's labs during my time there. Batteries to the Future, back from 2015. That's the episode of Fully Charged Batteries to the Future. Anyway, the point is that, he's based in Bristol. I happen to be in Bristol on work. And there's some very cool companies doing very cool things within the kind of EV / renewable space in Bristol. So we went and filmed a couple of sort of BBC4-esque deep technical conversations. And what was interesting was, although I was meant to be interviewing them, the conversation naturally switched around. So they started interviewing me because apparently people want to know about batteries. So, whenever Mark gets a chance to put those together, there will be some very professional looking episodes of Plug Life Television coming soon.
Wow.
And I'll tell you, if
we
can get any sort of sponsorship to do that, like, this is not an immediate appeal. I'm just saying, like, literally, if the financial clout was there, absolutely, we'd be going up and down the country, going into all of the amazing labs, not least visiting, not just Christoph had mentioned at Brill Power, but I have to give a shout out to Tajdin Amachayev and Joe Fleming at Coventry University. We used to work together at WMG, and we were kind of the academic three stooges, but we got on so well. Again, gelled as a team, did some amazing work together, and yeah, Taz was actually my next door neighbour by sheer fluke, because I remember a couple of months after starting at WMG, I started moving into my idyllic little sort of Tim Burton-esque, like, very tall, very skinny house in the chocolate box village of Kenilworth. And this guy appears at the balcony of this flat next door. It was Taz. He's like, are we neighbours now? It's like, oh, yes. that was a brilliant time because we just got on so well. I miss it. If you're listening, Taz and Joe, I do miss you terribly. And we definitely need to get a catch up next time I'm in the West Midlands. But yeah, again, there are really cool people I've met in all those different places I've been. But yeah, anyway, the point is I'd be totally going into all those labs, all those businesses. We'd be filming it. Mark would be making it look like a cinematic production, and Plug Life Television would finally get its reprieve. But it's time is the enemy right now. I'd love to do more Plug Life Television, but it's Plug Life Consulting that pays the bills. So that's the reality at the moment.
And that's a really important point, because, you know, Plug Life Consulting is a real force majeure in the space in which you operate. And, you know, as I'm sure everybody listening today will have understood, that you have a depth of knowledge that is almost certainly unrivaled in the marketplace, and also that ability to get that message out. And especially if you're already academic or battery focused or minded or in this space and understand many of the subjects and challenges that you speak of, you are the perfect person. And if you need any help, then do reach out to Plug Life Consulting. And obviously you can look back and answer a lot of those myths that we in the EV Cafe have done for the last 2 or 3 years as we've been going on our journey. We've reached out both to Plug Life Television and to you, and to answer many of the questions that are on our minds. So it's been fantastic, Ewan, and the idea that there is hope for the future of batteries is really a brilliant one, particularly bringing down the weight, increasing the energy density. And we didn't even get to talk about the speed of charge, but we won't. We'll worry about that for another day. Yeah. But Ewan, thank you so much. Please, everybody, John, final thought, goodbye, blah, blah.
No, I just think we're all blessed, really, that we've got on this planet somebody who is technically so brilliant and is also such a lovely human being and a decent person who's great at communicating, has passion, and wants to make a positive difference. Ewan, thank you.
What can I say, John? You're a good. Anyway, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much.
It's been a pleasure, and to know those real influences, and we will just give a special shout out to the memory of Laura.
Yeah.
You know, she's left a mark in you, Ewan, which will continue on for many years to come. We're grateful to all of the good people in your life and our lives and our community. Do head on over to the EV Cafe website, where you can hear all of the podcasts and check out all of the great people in our community and in our industry. And we've just added another great person to the Hall of the Takeaway Podcast Fame. Dr. Umatot, thank you so much, and we look forward to speaking to you again soon. Take care, everybody, and have a great day.
See ya.